Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's crossover week in the South Dakota State Legislature. Are you curious with how to keep up with SDPB's State House coverage? Well, there's a few ways you can stay informed. You can subscribe to the SDPB State House podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at SDPB News. At Facebook, just type in SDPB News. Go to YouTube, same thing, find the State House playlist on SDPB's YouTube channel. And if you go to sdpb.org, you can find the politics and public policy page. On Mondays, we're also welcoming SDPB journalists from across the state to join us for a legislative roundtable. And Wednesdays at noon Central, 11 Mountain, the Dakota Political Junkies join us for a commentary and analysis on the top state political headlines. So today, we welcome John Schaff and Mike Card. Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and he's joining us from the SDPB studios on the campus of University of South Dakota. Professor Card, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Lori, and good morning to Lori and John. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. John Schaff is Professor of Political Science at Northern State University in Aberdeen, and he's joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amann Foundation Studio on the campus of Northern. Professor Schaff, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you, and I ditto the good afternoon.
Let's talk to begin with. We've got a lot of education stories here, and they intersect kind of interestingly with this conversation that lawmakers had about funding education or funding prisons. So we'll get there eventually, but let's start with this plan that we've talked about before on this program about overhauling the Board of Regents, which failed, but legislation to ban unions and collective bargaining succeeded so far. It's still moving forward in the State House. John Schaff, give us an idea of kind of this whole, banning unions at public universities. We saw it last year start with the technical schools, this year public universities. Provide people with a little foundation for that conversation, please.
Well, first, it's worth noting that both Michael and I are employed by the regential system, and we're both part of the collective bargaining unit, whether we're members of the union or not. But obviously, we speak for ourselves on this. We don't speak for any entity in the moment. But that said, I think what's going on here is there's an attempt over the last handful of years for the legislature to exert some greater authority over the university, or more generically, the higher education system. Will include the technical schools in there as well. Is that, it's often stated that, for example, if the Board of Regents staff in Pierre was a separate university, budget-wise, it would be like a seventh university in the state. It's the budget is very big for the regential system. I think that's part of what was part of the motivation behind restructuring the Board of Regents in the sense, I think, trying to weaken the Board of Regents as a political entity. I think that was part of it for one of the parts of that bill was that they were going to ban people who live in a city that has one of the six regential institutions from being part of a board. Well, obviously, that's a way of getting people who are not as interested in protecting the university system as others are. And I think you see the same thing with the collective bargaining thing. It's a way that the state can have greater control over what goes on the universities. If the faculty are not allowed to unionize and then speak as one through our collective bargaining unit, COHE, in negotiating the terms of our employment, well, then what will happen is then a contract, in essence, gets dictated to us. What is now collectively bargained will be something that will simply be dictated to us by the Board of Regents, and there will be no negotiation. That's way of, I think, streamlining would be maybe a kind way to put it. And certainly, the state being able to exert more influence over what happens in higher ed.
COHE stands for the Council of Higher Education. And Mike Card, if you could speak more broadly about, or specifically about, a contract being dictated versus, because it seems to me that the first thing that would jump out would be, priorities might be different. So some people might say you want more money, but professors and faculty might say, well, actually what we want is this instead. So it sort of takes the opportunity for a back and forth out of the conversation. What else?
Well, I mean, to begin with, I also need to, as John noted, to disclaim that I am an employee of the Board of Regents and the opinions I state are my own. I am a dues-paying member of the Council of Higher Education, and I speak for myself and not for the Council on Higher Education. The terms and conditions of employment largely have to do with the teaching, research, and service activities of the faculty. Salary, benefits, and other working conditions are management prerogatives that belong to the South Dakota Board of Regents under our Constitution. So we're not going to get higher pay unless the regents decide we're going to get higher pay. It's not subject to bargaining. What is within the realm of the faculty is the control of the curriculum. And to some extent, we can negotiate procedures, such as if I were to decide not to show up for my classes this evening, I certainly would be subject to due process rights. But more or less, it's not a job guarantee having a contract. That contract can be terminated for cause, and I believe there are 14 different causes, including being intoxicated at work, much less to actually not performing my job. So I think I am performing my job, but
hypothetically, if a faculty member was not performing his or her job, yes.
Right, and the Board of Regents can negotiate if they negotiate in good faith according to the South Dakota Department of Labor's administrative law judges, they can impose a contract. So in some senses, this really isn't different than what we're living under now, which is an imposed contract.
Okay, so help me understand, because I think there's a gap in my knowledge here. Dr. Card, when you said teaching and research and curriculum, what does that mean, the influence, that there can be an outside influence in what research you can do?
Well, without an employment contract that specifies that that is the realm of the faculty, that can certainly happen. You know, and we think, you know, we have short memories. We think back to 1966-67 school year, where a couple faculty at Northern State, then college, now university, were terminated, and it put the Board of Regents on a watch list where we were not a recommended employer because the terminations weren't for cause. They were teaching ideas and evaluating those ideas.
So this goes back to what we were aiming at. I was kind of thinking about the tech school faculty last year, but this also goes back to what we were talking about, the First Amendment, and some lawmakers saying that the right ideas weren't being taught, and there was some conversation in peer about that. And I'm not off there, am I?
Well, there's certainly concern that we are indoctrinating students, and, you know, I don't like to speak for my own opinion, but if we're indoctrinating students, we're not changing them very much. Students in South Dakota are much like their parents. They are fairly conservative for the most part, as are a good percentage of the faculty. It depends upon where you are in a university as to whether you have a more political ideology that is liberal or a political ideology that we would label as being conservative. I've had the pleasure of teaching in the business school and in the Department of Political Science, and they're very different places, as would be the English department and occupational therapy. Where you're at often determines the exploration of ideas with respect to existing works of both literature and thought, and we try to teach students to critique all ideas and think for themselves and determine. There are some things that there is almost an overwhelming amount of evidence that suggests one particular fact to be a fact, and those aren't subject to interference, or shouldn't be, perhaps.
Dr. Schaff, talk a little bit about this idea of what happens next for, because I'm thinking about, you know, we've talked about recruiting physicians in the state recently in this program, recruiting professors and faculty members. What does it mean if there isn't collective bargaining rights and if there are these efforts from lawmakers to control, dictate, put their thumb on the lever? I'm not sure how I would say this about curriculum and research in higher education.
Well, I think there's a couple things worth noting. One, this hasn't become law yet.
Right.
We still have to go through the House of Representatives, so we're not sure it's going to become a law. But let's just assume it does. What one of the things Michael is getting at, in some ways we'd be at status quo. No, the union, South Dakota is a right-to-work state. You know, Michael said he's a dues-paying member of the union. I am not. All right? I have a right not to join the union. And our union is relatively weak, and oftentimes our collective bargaining agreement is literally simply imposed on us because the union doesn't have a lot of negotiating strength. But I think what's going – so in some ways, there's no guarantee or there's no suggestion anything would be changed, except that at this point – there'd be much more freedom from the board or the state to impose things like what your terms of employment are, what your workload is, what kinds of academic rank there are, what kinds of rights or due process do faculty have. And I can't imagine that it would be a net positive for recruiting faculty to the state. We already have struggles in that. We pay far lower. I mean, I know because we have this thing called the Oklahoma Study, which is a study of basically a survey of national faculty salaries. And I personally am paid $35,000 a year below the national average for someone in my discipline and at my term of service and my rank, which is full professor. And so our pay is low. There are often struggles because the remoteness of South Dakota of doing professional activities. And then should the board use this power to then impose other kinds of kind of unfriendly terms of employment upon faculty, well, it only makes it that much more unattractive for people to work in the state. Now, this is, I guess it's a thing that we often come across this when we talk about what the state legislature is doing, is it, this seems once again like a solution in search of a problem, is I'm not exactly sure what the problem is because the faculty negotiation is weak. We have a contract basically imposed on us every collective bargaining session. And I'm not exactly sure what the state gains other than the potential for greater wiggle room on the part of whether it's the Board of Regents or the legislature to not have to deal with the collective bargaining unit when it wants to make changes. It could simply impose them instead of it having to be collectively bargained.
I think their argument is it is going to open the door to be more nimble and fluid in going forward.
Well,
as I look at the testimony, that seems to be the consensus, is that it's not. Here's what I've heard before. It's not necessary. Because it's the time of unions is long past. I've heard that argument from lawmakers, and then I've also heard the argument we need a little more flexibility, so we need a little more influence and the ability to keep these universities vital.
Well, I don't discount that. I mean, centralization of authority is always more efficient, isn't it? I think there's a principled argument to make, and I've heard people make the argument against public sector unions. And I don't want to rehearse all that,
right.
but I think there's a principled argument to be made for that. My point would just simply be, the public sector unions, and in this case, COHE, in South Dakota are relatively weak unions. I'm not entirely sure how much more nimble the state could be because it's already pretty dang nimble. So it seems in this sense almost punitive that it's being done simply because it can be done as opposed to solving a problem like somehow faculty are getting away with something or somehow we are intransigent in our negotiating demands to the Board of Regents because it's the exact opposite, I would say, is the case. Mm.
Centralization is always more efficient, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike Card, are they going for K-12 educators in the next legislative session? Do you see this as a potential walking from tech schools to higher ed to K-12 teachers and their collective bargaining rights?
Well, it was certainly mentioned during the legislation that removed the right to bargain collectively by the technical school faculty. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that if I were a K-12 administrator, I would be looking forward to not having to collectively bargain with K-12 school teachers.
All right, let's go from higher education way back to the beginning and early childhood education, because Representative Aaron Healy, a Democrat from Sioux Falls, District 14, once again brought a bill saying let's have a council to study the accessibility and affordability and impact of early childhood education. That was rejected. And I bring it up now not because it failed, but because it also reminds us that yesterday in Rapid City, voters declined to pass a school bond to help improve their elementary schools that really had a high threshold for what needed to pass, and that failed. And then lawmakers had this conversation about presumptive probation. If you listen to that debate on the floor, you heard a lot of talk about, I think Chris Langer, who voted against it, a Republican Party leader in the Senate, said, you know, we're going to be asked to fund a women's prison. We're going to be asked to fund more, more jails and incarceration. We really should be funding treatment. And by the way, we have to, we want to provide those cost of living raises for teachers and state employees and providers. So there's this interesting, conversation that harkens back to the old axiom about funding schools or funding jails and prisons. A lot converging here in this conversation. Mike Card, where do you want to start with that thread?
Well, I think one thing is I suspect we could speak about the Rapid City bond issue. The proponents achieved about 57% of the vote to fund a bond issue. 60% of the vote is required, what's called a supermajority or a substantial majority. There was 13 inches of snow in Rapid City yesterday. My political science-y type background says that if you want bad weather, because usually the opponents stay home when there's bad weather. So I suspect that that there just isn't much support. You know, and part of what we deal with in many areas of South Dakota is a bimodal distribution of income. And with yesterday's talk where you had Tanchi Weaver on, I believe that was yesterday, mm-hmm. Your conversation suggested that they didn't know what was going on, and you tried to lead Ms. Weiner to recognize that there was plenty of information available on how the funds were going to be spent, what they were going to be spent for. And it appeared to me that she was having none of it.
A fair assessment of the conversation, yes. Yeah.
One of the things that you haven't mentioned is that South Dakota Public Broadcasting supplies the video or the audio of all committee hearings so people can find things for themselves. This is another one that you can listen to the interview and find out the arguments that were given. And basically, Rapid City hasn't funded a bond issue. They've used higher interest rate tax anticipation notes and the like since 1973 to fund their improvements in schools. The suggestion that we can, hire a school sentinel to improve safety in our schools is in and of itself a fairly controversial idea, rather than restricting access to the school by people from the outside. So, I think in politics we do trade-offs, and the trade-off with a bimodal distribution of income is there are lots of people that don't have very much money, and $20 a month in increased property taxes might be prohibitive. On the other hand, we want better schools, because we're not going to have a better lifestyle if we don't at least get a primary and secondary education that enables us to function in our society.
John Schaff, anything you want to add to that, or do you want to jump on to presumptive probation and expand on that a little bit?
No, I'll just say one thing is that I guess we'll dovetail into presumptive probation is what Michael's getting at is, politics is all about priorities. At least it's largely about priorities. And so whenever you're dealing with these issues like the bond issue in Rapid City, it's a statement of priorities. And one of the proponents of the bond issue, so person on the losing side, after the vote yesterday said that the oddity that if they would have been voting to build a prison, it would have passed because they only need a simple majority. to build prisons, but to spend extra money on schools, we need supermajorities to opt out and to raise money for schools. And so that's a statement of priorities. And so what South Dakota happens to be a very tax-averse state, and that means you really have to push people to get them to see the good of your priority, if that priority means extra revenue, if it means extra taxation. And it seems like the fellow couple percentage points, what was it, 56%, I guess, was the vote in Rapid City. They fell short. And so it's all about convincing people that this is really a priority that the state needs to get behind in all the various iterations that education takes place within the state and local government.
All right, let's talk presumptive probation, because this is I watched this live on SDPB TV last night, and it was in a very interesting debate on Senate Bill 6, and it passed 19-16. And when they were doing the yays and the nays, I was trying to count, and I was like, I lost count. It's too close. And fortunately, the Senate did not lose count. So it move on to its next stage. But this is Jason Roundsburg's bill, and he brought a presumptive probation bill last session, and it failed. And one of the things that I found compelling about this testimony was Senator Lance Russell's kind of plea that it's time to support the Attorney General, and still 16 people said not on this one. So let's talk a little bit about the influence of Roundsburg and what he's trying to get through, and how successful he's being at first. Mike Card?
Well, I think perhaps the first thing to do is to explain what presumptive probation is for people, and that is if you're convicted of a minor drug crime, that you are placed on probation, hopefully where you can, if you admit help, you can go to one of the unified judicial system's drug courts and get yourself straight with the world so that you can be a productive member of society. Without presumptive probation, the presumption is that you'll get probation and have supervised release where you have to report to your probation officer. If you don't cooperate and you don't agree to those things, such as you fight the charges or still convicted, then you would be incarcerated in the state penitentiary for a period of time. So presumptive probation is trying to keep people out of the prison system where they don't learn new bad habits to go with the bad habits they already have, and to try to get people straight. So I think that's important to understand. The issue of Attorney General, I can never pronounce
Roundsburg.
His name.
Roundsburg.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is to try to get cooperation. And I think Judge Rush last night on the debate noted, if cooperation, which doesn't seem to be defined in Senate Bill 6, means that we want you to go in and make a drug buy. He noted, well, that's exactly what we shouldn't be doing to someone who has a drug habit, is putting them in a position. If they're threatened by revealing information about their supplier of drugs when they were ostensibly the reason for which they were convicted, their family may be threatened and they may choose, My family can have violence, or I can go to jail. I think I'll choose jail. That's a Hobbesian choice. There's no good answer to that particular one, and I'm not sure what we're trying to accomplish with eliminating presumptive probation, other than locking people up.
We are going to have to leave it here for this week and talk more about this in the future. Dr. Mike Card at the University of South Dakota and Dr. John Schaff at Northern State University, we appreciate both of your time. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.